Evening, Mel. Can you hear me? It's been a month, so I'm about that well.
Been an exciting month. Yeah, it's been an exciting month, though. I gotta be honest. For a split second, I almost forgot we were in a never-ending pandemic, being distracted by all the toxic train derailments and Chinese spy balloons. It's been a very exciting month.
I just feel like it's been a long-ass month. Like... I know for me, I've had like so much going on at work that I've been trying to keep going sort of outside of all the other stuff that's going on. But yeah, February's just felt like getting hit by a train.
Should we give some updates before we jump in and have Daniel Duggar join us tonight?
Yeah, so I was off of the... data for a little bit because I've just been trying to maintain my sanity, which I'm barely doing. Yeah. But we see that there's been not much shift in terms of the resources on Island Health. So we saw that both Port Hardy and Cormorant Island Health Center, they were closed overnight, dating back to December and January. So those are still sort of closed overnight. And we see that Dr. Alex Nataros, I think that's how you say his name, is doing a lot of advocacy out in the Port Hardy area because he's the only emergency doctor out there. So he's been fighting to get a physician's assistant for months now. And Adrian Dix sort of refuses to respond to a lot of the stuff he's doing. So shout out to Dr. Nataros as well. He's on Twitter, so someone to follow. We had another ambulance delay-related death recently, so it's been a little bit since we saw that. Let me pull that up. So last time we had this was in November, but we're pulling up around to this is the ninth death in BC related to just staffing resources and ambulances. So we saw... an article from February 16th, if you check it out on CBC News, title is BC Man Dies of Heart Attack While Local Ambulance Not Staffed Due to Illness. So this individual was a man in his 60s who died a few blocks away from the hospital while waiting for the ambulance. So this is sort of something that has become more typical in the areas. We've seen this more over the last year in particular, but that definitely won't stop. So that was something that's come out. Dix is nowhere to be found to talk about it. So that's sort of like hospital stuff. What else is there, Mel? Anything you can think of that I should cover? Can anybody hear me?
Yes, I can. these apps are, this Twitter, I tell you, it's kind of gone downhill, I think, a little bit.
Oh, it is such a mess, Daniel. So in the last, like, 2 weeks, I've been locked out of my account. I've been suspended. I just keep getting blocked from tweeting. I put a note on my personal account, which people can see I'm recording from Project Canary tonight, that I won't be deleting my personal account, but I'm going to be just clearing it out. Oh, hello, Mel.
Did we all just get disconnected there for a second? It seems like that.
I think it's been all over the place in terms of who's disconnected where. Oh, Elmo's fucking goodness. With us.
Oh yeah, he doesn't want us talking about.
Yeah, so we had the ninth article up death on the bchospitaldata.com. So that's where I'm still tracking everything related to the BC healthcare systems. So on there is sort of the hospital and urgent care directory still, where I keep everything updated with regards to any hospital closures or urgent care directory stuff. We've also got the long-term care directory there. So I do an update on the outbreaks every week so that you can see where the outbreaks are going. And we can sort of see now that I've been tracking them for over a year now, what the pattern is to those as well and where the more hard hit homes are. We've got our COVID data. I'm a few weeks behind on that because really it's not usable data anyway. So I just keep updating it as I go. What else do we have? Closures and disruptions news. So Kamloops, the largest maternity clinic, is closing there. So that's been something that's come up recently. Eagle Ridge Hospital still having issues. Oh, one good piece of news. Here, we have good news. Courtney, BC is putting up air quality monitors, outdoor ones for wood smoke, but hey, we've got something coming along the way related to air.
And IKEA is taking out or selling too.
Mel, I'm still hearing your speaker is wonky. Is anybody else hearing that? Can somebody give me a thumbs up if they're hearing Mel is wonky?
It is wonky, yeah.
Okay, Mel, do you have a different head pair of headphones or something that you can join with?
This is literally just my phone. There's no headphones. How about now?
That seems better.
Okay, I apologize, everyone. I don't know what's going on.
I can't hear.
Nah, you're still cutting out there, Mel.
Oh no.
That's okay. Okay, we'll go off cuff here. Daniel, we've chatted before. I've seen you in the spaces. Mel sent me an article about what you were going to talk about tonight, the acronym SAND. Would you care to give me a bit of an intro to what you were planning to talk about tonight, or set the stage for us a little bit in terms of the info we'll be talking about?
Yeah, so I began my research. Well, I'll go back. I'm no longer affiliated with them. But in 2015, I was extended an invitation to sit on the board at Vanderbilt's HIV/AIDS Clinical Trial Group because of my advocacy work in the long COVID community and some of the things that I've posted about the use of Truvada. Vanderbilt essentially asked that I no longer be affiliated with them. But so last year, I was contacted by a client of mine. I own a software development company here in Franklin, Tennessee, and I have clients across the country. And we were talking, and he told me that he had contracted SARS-CoV-2 and was having brain fog issues. And so I started to do some Googling, and I ran across a study from the University of California at San Francisco. Dr. Apple was one of the authors of that study, and they sought to measure the level of cognitive impairment in those living with a chronic SARS-CoV-2 infection because there is not a test that's been validated for SARS-CoV-2. They relied upon the one that is used to measure the impairment in those living with HIV-associated neurocognitive decline. And in reading that study, what stuck out to me and is very concerning, and it should be to everyone, is that 70% of the individuals in the control arm, meaning they did not complain of any cognitive impairment whatsoever, actually satisfy the diagnostic criteria for asymptomatic neurocognitive impairment. And in light of the fact there is nothing being done to prevent that disease progression, those individuals are moving to mild neurocognitive decline. And finally, the end stage disease will be the functional equivalent of AIDS dementia complex. So once I learned of that study, I started to put all these pieces together. Then came a paper from Dr. Anna Pepe. And the title of it is Tunneling Nanotubes Provide a Route for SARS-CoV-2 Spreading. Then I read Dr. Daniel Chertow's study in which viral persistence was observed in the central nervous system, which is one of the two reservoirs. And I'm just kind of laying the groundwork. Then I'm going to go into more detail as to, you know, how all of this stuff works. But I then learned that there is a depletion of the CD4 cells, which appears on Merck Medical's website under acquired lymphocytopenia. So it was at that time that I said, hey, you know what? We can borrow from 40 years of HIV medicine and apply it to what people have benignly called brain fog. And so I took HIV-associated neurocognitive decline and substituted the virus for that and came up with SAND and have started a company performing neurocognitive assessments and doing some neuroplasticity work, which I can further expound on later. And so if we were to apply the principles of HIV medicine to this particular virus, there are a number of concepts that, you know, we have failed to pay attention to. And the one that's of most importance is to allow an individual to maintain their immune competence and at the same time preserve their cognition. And so when we are looking at doing that, we can borrow from what Dr. Jason Oculitz and other individuals observed as a result of their study. And it is, the concept is referred to as the estimated date of seroconversion. That is when the individual starts to form antibodies, feels like crap. They've got the headache, they've got the runny nose, they've got, you know, body aches and whatever else that's happening. And so there was a study by the name of Influence of the Timing of Antiretroviral Therapy on the Potential for a Normalization of Immune Status in Human Immunodeficiency Virus 1 Infected Individuals. And so what they observed is that if an individual initiates antivirals within that 1 year estimated date of seroconversion, then there is what's referred to as a normalization of the CD4 cells. And so those cells will actually return to a pre-infection level. Outside of that time, there will be somewhat of a normalization, but it certainly won't be as great of a normalization as would be experienced had they initiated earlier. If you look at the graph, you know, we hear of a window period in HIV, which is 90 days for those antibodies to, you know, for an individual to have the antibodies to be able to be tested. and so, you know, they actually, on their graph, they have essentially the one of the arrow or both arrows are at that 3 month mark. And so, you know, the rapid initiation of the antivirals will allow for that normalization. And additionally, what it will prevent against is what's referred to as reservoir seeding. And so earlier I mentioned the central nervous system, right, as a reservoir for both HIV and SARS-CoV-2. There's also an additional reservoir with both of those viruses, and it's the GALT. So from our mouth to our anus, we have the largest lymphoid organ in our body, the gut-associated lymphoid tissues. And with both of those viruses, it has been already documented that the virus is able to persist in those areas. The consequence of allowing for reservoir expansion is that antivirals are unable to reach those areas like they're able to reach the virus in the peripheral blood. So virus is able to continue to replicate in those areas. You know, like I said, the antivirals are unable to penetrate and clear the reservoir. and so that's the issue with HIV and the fact that there isn't a cure is that those reservoirs and latent cells cannot be cleared out. What's interesting about this virus, so the GALT is actually involved. We thought, okay, that the initial hypothesis for this respiratory virus, right, is that we are going to have people, you know, breathing through their nose, right? And then the virus moves up the nose to the olfactory nerve, from the olfactory nerve to the olfactory bulb, right? And then from the olfactory bulb to the entorhinal cortex, and then from the entorhinal cortex to the rhinal cortex. Well, the entorhinal cortex is where it's part of the limbic system and critically important for memory formation. Now I've got a paper over here that it implicates the gut-associated lymphoid tissue in infection as well, just like it does with HIV. You know, HIV involves the pyre patches in the lower portion of the, you know, intestines at the anus, right? Well, there's this hypothesis referred to as the zonulin hypothesis. And so essentially what the authors of that study said is that people will swallow mucus or I guess some of the people I've worked with, they've even, you know, they breathe through their mouth as opposed to their nose. So they're swallowing this virus, right? It moves down the GI tract, and then there is this breakdown of that intestinal barrier function. And then the virus travels up the vagus nerve to the brain. So it's pretty interesting how that works. But I will let me touch on a few other things that are kind of unique and things that we've already observed. I'm sure you've probably seen a lot of my tweets, but one of the things, the primary driver of HIV infection, and I would suggest a SARS-CoV-2 infection, is the loss of the intestinal barrier function. So both viruses will cause that to be broken down. The end result of that is intestinal contents move their way into systemic circulation. The medical term for that is microbial translocation, and the predominant marker that is used for measuring the degree of microbial translocation is that of lipopolysaccharide. And so when we have intestinal contents, lipopolysaccharide leaving where it's supposed to be and moving into systemic circulation, that results in the chronic immune system activation that we're seeing. It leads to immune system senescence or premature aging, and it heavily contributes to neurocognitive impairment. Because all of these things are now, you know, circulating in the central nervous system, and obviously that's not where they're supposed to belong. Additionally, we hear of people complaining of shortness of breath. what's responsible for that principally is, there's IL-6, number one, but predominantly the cytokine responsible for that is that of tumor necrosis factor alpha. And so we have people suffering from shortness of breath and an inability for synaptogenesis to take place. What's interesting is when elevated, tumor necrosis factor alpha causes a reduction in brain-derived neurotrophic factor. So you cannot form new synapses when you're short of breath. It's pretty remarkable how all of this is interrelated. Let me see what else I was going to touch on. I know there's a number of things. I don't know why I forgot this, but earlier we were talking about the fact that, you know, there is this reduction of CD4 cells. And so not only do we need to be paying attention to that estimated day of seroconversion, there's another concept that needs to be paid attention to, and that is an individual CD4 nadir, or the lowest CD4 count that an individual has. Ronald Ellis sought to measure or determine the interrelationship between neuropsychological issues and the CD4 nadir, and he determined that the lower the CD4 nadir dropped, the more predictive it was of neuropsychological impairments. One of the other things that I've talked about before is blood-brain barrier penetration rates, and the fact that, you know, our first-line medications, so that they aren't neurotoxic, they do not penetrate the blood-brain barrier to the same degree as earlier medications, when, you know, people were still trying to learn, you know, not only about the disease, but the medications that they were going to use to manage it. And so when we're talking about antivirals, we need to be thinking about, okay, well, how are we going to, you know, onboard these antivirals in individuals who have had their kidneys and their livers impaired as a consequence of them having ACE2 receptors in them. And there was a study done by the VA that looked at the degree of kidney impairment, and it was profound. This is in the article I sent you, but there was a 59.38 incidence rate of acute kidney injury. There was a 100.45 incidence rate for those individuals with an estimated glomerular filtration rate, or EGFR, equal to or below 30. 50.66 incidence rate for those with an EGFR equal to or below 40, 28.61 incidence rate for those with an EGFR equal to or below 50, and a 4.65 incidence rate of end-stage kidney disease. So there's going to be three classes of individuals. There's going to be those that will be able to initiate and maintain antivirals, or initiate for sure. How long they'll be able to maintain, I don't know. They will be able to initiate with the full dosage of the medication. There will be a second group of individuals that will be able to initiate, but not take the full amount
as prescribed, which is going to lead to insufficient suppression of the virus and allow for forward transmission to continue. And finally, the third group will not be able to initiate medications at all. You know, it's not addressed in this article, but, you know, antivirals do impact bone mineral density at the hip and spine as well. And this virus is causing osteoporosis in individuals. So there are a number of things that had we paid attention to them early on, we would be, you know, in a much better place.
Question for you, Daniel.
Yes.
Just something that I've been thinking about just as you've been talking and sort of side thoughts I've been having, because we have seen more and more findings now of that sort of organ impairment from COVID. And I posted one of the recent articles in the chat, as well as several of the articles you've been talking about as well, so people can look at them. But I'm seeing like a lot of, and I don't know if you can say that you've seen anything like this, but across sort of liver and some heart stuff coming out now in lungs in terms of fibrosis. And how does this impact sort of the use of the retrovirals or any of that stuff? Like, will the issues we're seeing with organ impairment, how much will that impair our ability to actually treat it, do you think?
I think it's going to greatly greatly impacted. You know, the kidneys and liver obviously are responsible for metabolizing and excreting antivirals. And then again, like I said, the bone mineral density. I know you have seen my post over and over and over again about Paxlovid. And people have ignored the warnings and are still talking about them, not investigating any other trials or any other medications to trial. Well, they're doing so without Googling anything. It is so easy to sit down and to Google. Ritonavir, let me just say this, okay? A lot of y'all probably know, but if you don't, I contracted HIV on June the 13th of 2015 and was introduced into care in September of 2015. And I had a viral load in that short of a period of time of 60,000 copies. obviously, I've done a tremendous amount of research into my own condition, which is why Vanderbilt allowed me to sit on their board. And that's the reason why it was very easy for me to sit down and draw the parallels between the pathophysiological processes taking place between these two viruses. I am not on a protease-based inhibitor regimen. They don't use those. I am on it's actually the two drugs are of the same class that China is using. The nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitor, two of them, is referred to as a double nuke, and on top of that sits an integrase inhibitor. There's very good reason why protease inhibitors, and especially ritonavir, are not used in HIV medicine. They will lead to the development of type 2 diabetes. They will lead to hypertriglyceridemia, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, lipodystrophy, which is a hunchback, and finally, endothelial damage, which everyone has been talking about. Endothelial damage has been observed in individuals or in pork vessels within 24 hours of administration. Insulin resistance has developed within 7 days in the HIV negative population. So they gave HIV negative people ritonavir to see what it would do to them, and it caused insulin resistance within 7 days. So, you know, the long COVID community, you know, is going to find itself in a very difficult position because it has been allowed to decompensate And then is going to further burden the organs that have been damaged through the use of ritonavir. The rates of myocardial infarction or heart attacks in those on a ritonavir-based regimen are extremely high. After all, ritonavir causes a reduction in nitric oxide, which results in vasoconstriction or a narrowing of the blood vessels. So it's like the worst case scenario, you know, and I have brought up a viral load test over and over again, but we don't have one. And I have no clue what people's viral loads must be if they were a first waiver at this point. And so it's not good, not good at all, because there's literature out here talking about folks with hypometabolic frontal lobes. Well, there's also literature out here talking about folks with HIV and hypometabolic brains. So we can get a really good idea of how long it will take, more than likely, to resolve that hypometabolism in the frontal lobe based upon our previous experience. And it's 2 years. So, you know, I don't think that an individual can tolerate a ritonavir boosted protease inhibitor, which, you know, that the main ingredients of protease inhibitors as well. So you're getting two protease inhibitors. There's not enough data on the main ingredient for anyone to be able to draw any conclusions other than the drug class that it belongs to. What kind of shape? Number one, is the person going to be alive to see their hypometabolism resolve? And number two, what kind of shape will they be in if they make it that long? You know, those, I think, are very valid concerns based upon journal articles that have been written ad nauseum, just like, you know, journal articles are being written ad nauseum right now, and there's no action being taken. So it's like the biggest disaster ever, man.
What's up, Mel?
I have a question for Daniel. So you're talking about viral loads.
Yes.
And the persistence of the virus in the body, because the Nature article, you know, they did the autopsies on the 44 patients, and they found the persistence virus even in non-respiratory tissue like the brain.
Yes.
What do you think is going to be the end result when you have children that are getting reinfected over and over again? I know some kids that are on their fourth COVID infection. Like, what does that do to their brains when you found the virus in tissues like parts of the brain, like the hypothalamus, that is responsible for hunger and satiety? And I'm hearing stories and anecdotes of kids becoming ravenous and not being able to stop and regulate their eating and sleeping. And then they found the virus in the corpus callosum, which is,
yes,
interesting, because then you have, you know, the corpus callosum is responsible for like impulse control and emotional regulation and empathy.
Yeah. And you are 100% right. I have a screen that I do my SAM scan. Mm-hmm. You were talking about Daniel Chertow's study from the NIH. And so when I sat down to put all of this together, you know, I wanted to try to help someone identify, to number one, identify their deficits and to kind of give them an idea of, hey, this is where the virus may be in your body or your brain based upon the deficits, right? And so I went through and I looked at all the regions of the brain and what they're responsible for. And you're right, the corpus callosum When insulted, an individual can no longer assess the risk. They spread misinformation, believing that it's true. And one individual in New York, she almost fell off of a rock ledge three times. She had to catch herself three times. And it's remarkable. But you were talking about hunger. I call it people are being left homeless. HOME being capitalized for homeostasis, olfaction, memory, and emotion, because that's exactly what's happening. We have this virus that is set up in the very region where Alzheimer's disease has been, the loss of smell or the anosmia impacts the same region with Alzheimer's disease. And so there is a concept that I was reading about. I was invited to speak with the Alzheimer's Association. There was a doctor out of Cyprus that used my same term, but he called it disorder instead of decline for some reason. And so he introduced me into a concept called the antimicrobial protection hypothesis. We know that lots of folks are dealing with clotting, disseminated intravascular coagulation. That is an innate immune response to prevent the spreading of that virus throughout the entire body. And so that also occurs in the brain as well in the form of amyloid deposition. And so, we are going to have a massive cluster on our hands because we're going to have individuals, these kids, right? They have osteoclasts that are hyperactive. So we know in HIV and now in SARS-CoV-2 that there is this concept of the Trojan horse that is participating. So we have monocytes, right? And then they can differentiate into a macrophage or monocyte-derived macrophages. Those macrophages can then differentiate into an osteoclast. So we have osteoclasts and osteoblasts that participate in the process of bone remodeling. So we have young kids whose epithelial or growth plates have not closed and their bones have yet to be formed. And now we have a situation where the osteoclasts are destroying more bone than is being laid down. And so additionally, when that happens, one reason why postmenopausal women suffer such cognitive impairment is because they're developing osteoporosis and osteopontin is being secreted from those bones and makes its way into the central nervous system and contributes to neurocognitive impairment. And so, yeah, those kids, they're losing T cells. Their thymus is being impacted. They're having the osteoporosis. It's going to impact their teeth because the greatest concentration of osteoclasts is in the jaw because of the mechanical stress of eating. And so Then you have the neurocognitive impairment, the reduction in CD4 cells. And, you know, I mean, what comes next is what I tweeted about earlier, where they posted, it was out of Europe, opportunistic infections. Pneumocystis carinii pneumonia. Then there's
the funguses, right? The aspergilluses that are out in the environment, right? These are the opportunistic infections.
Yeah, one that they did not mention, which I was kind of shocked. A lot of people have CMV, that's latent cytomegalovirus, and it's seen in the HIV positive population, which is CMV retinitis. And people can go blind over that. So they did mention cryptococcal meningitis. It's really the biggest damn disaster I've ever seen. And I think what amazes me the most about this whole thing is that nobody seems to be able to draw any parallels. That the medical profession, its members have zero interest in saving themselves. They're continuing to engage in the same thing. You know, they're thinking, oh, well, this is just another chronic disease, and so we'll just continue to write journal articles and do what we've always done because we're comfortable. You know, we can sit behind our computer and go ahead and you know, write up a journal article citing 50 other journal articles, or 60, or, you know, however many in the table of contents or authority section. And we'll talk about this very same thing that, you know, 50 other people talked about. But, you know, we've got this research money that we've got to burn up. And so we're just going to go ahead and talk about it. And meanwhile, their colleagues are suffering from a chronic SARS-CoV-2 infection. And they don't care, you know? I mean, they don't care. There is no call to action on Twitter by anybody in the medical profession. There's no calls for drug repurposing or any of this, you know? And it's just fucking mind-boggling to me, you know, because I am familiar. So we've got the medical community, right, that's being impacted, okay? I have attorneys reaching out to me in DMs. One of them has a MoCA score of a 21. So the cutoff for a normal MoCA score is 26. And he's at 21. So you tell me how you are going to go anywhere and represent anybody in court and make sure that their due process rights aren't being violated. You're not.
Well, and what's the insidious part about anything related to the brain, too, is that when you don't have an established baseline, right, most people won't have any sort of established baseline to go from. So those even at the highest rates of productivity may be dropping down to average, but the impacts it will have society-wide would matter, right? Large scale.
Yeah, what? And you know what's... Morgan Stevenson is a journalist, and she wrote that on Valentine's Day, she went to go have an MRI and voxel-based morphometry done, which, you know, is a process by which they seek to measure cortical thickness in voxels, which is like it's a grid, like a Cartesian or grid, you know, you've got, you know, like grid paper, essentially, right? And then they take each voxel and they measure the cortical thickness. Well, they've done that in AIDS patients. What do you do to stop cortical atrophy? Antivirals. So, you know, people are suffering profoundly. You know, their future is being shaped, and it's being shaped towards senility, in a way that's going to lead to senility. And there's absolutely no reason for it, because we know that if you onboard antivirals, you're going to arrest that cortical atrophy. It's written in journal articles, you know, but those journal articles are being ignored. And so why is the big question, you know, who needs to step up and say, enough journal article writing, folks. We know what's happening because we can draw parallels. We need to take action because this is a chronic disease that will not be able to be managed. With the millions of people that are living with this condition, who's going to take care of them? How, you know, we're 1981, June of 1981, about 9 days before I was born, the first individual presented with Kaposi sarcoma. And that started that whole cluster. Well, we are essentially in, I don't know, 1970-something, right? And we have these individuals that are showing up with this and that and whatever else. And nobody knows what to do, so they don't do anything. Then they wait 10 years later, and some poor bastard's being eat up by pneumonia or Kaposi sarcoma, and people are like, oh, no, well, we still don't know what to do.
Yes. Like, British Columbia just closed all of its in-person long COVID clinics to virtual clinics and are essentially slowing down services, despite the fact clearly the rates aren't going anywhere but up.
And we are still actively infecting children in unmitigated schools, packed to the gills, because we are told that, what, kids can't get COVID. And today's National Post article saying that, by minimizers, saying kids don't get it so bad. I'm sorry, there's a 19-year-old with Alzheimer's now.
Exactly.
Is it COVID-related? Probably. I mean, if you find the virus in the thalamus, and in the brain, in the cerebral cortex, the thalamus is responsible not only for consciousness, learning, and memory. It's also responsible for imagination. So the multiple kids that you are infecting right now, you are injuring their brains that affects their imagination, which is tied intimately with play and learning. So you're going to have a generation of children with brain injuries. That is going to affect them for the rest of their lives.
Yes, you will.
From lockdown, right?
No, yeah, they're saying it's from lockdown. What bullshit, okay?
I couldn't help myself. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
Well, and you know, it's also impacting individuals' testicles and their reproductive organs. And, you know, so who's going to be around to even procreate? And I can tell you, I'll tell you one thing, everybody, since you mentioned it, you know, I asked people about their sex drive. It's non-existent. These people don't want to have sex. They're just trying to stay alive. So the idea that, you know, we've got people that are young enough to bear children, and they're going to with this neurological impairment, why would they? Why would anybody want to have a kid that could, and they can't even take care of themselves? I mean, that's just laughable.
Well, I would say that's a bit ableist, and there's many children that are born with different cognitive capacities that are well-loved and taken care of. So I want to be careful with the language we use about that.
I'm talking about the parents. I'm talking about the parents not wanting to have sex is what I'm talking about. But from a being born with cognitive impairments, I'm right there with you. I was born with communicating hydrocephalus, dysgenesis of the corpus callosum, agenesis of the cerebellum vermis, and to top it all off, colpocephaly. So, it's a challenge, you know. The advantage I think that I have over others that I'm dealing with is that I was born with all that. I've had the benefit of adapting over all of these years, as opposed to being born with a normal anatomy and physiology, and then experiencing an insult so late in life. The compensation, piece, is not there. You know, I've undergone, you know, I'd say quite a bit of compensation as a result of all that impairment when I was born. So, I'm more than sympathetic to the situation that people are in, and children especially. So, it's not that I think that they're going to be born and not loved. And I'm just thinking, you know, how many people that haven't had children, that want to have children, don't have children because they're battling for their own life. You know, they're battling for their autonomy on a daily basis. You know, some of the people don't even know if they're going to have a job or if they're actually going to be homeless. You know?
Well, and I've seen people approaching, you know, sadly already that conversation about MAID, right? That they're like, there's going to be no treatments or no attention paid to this, that those are the options they're looking at, which again is just horrifying from the perspective of Canada in particular has just been, you know, not dealing with any of the psychosocial supports that need to be there and are going to up this other option instead of taking care of anybody, which I realize is the same almost everywhere right now, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, it's disgusting, you know, because not only, first and foremost, right, that's a human life, and you let that person down because you lack the intellectual curiosity to figure this shit out, or to listen to someone that has a pretty good idea of what's going on, and, you know, entertain what they have to say. But beyond that, you know, for every life that's lost, that's going to impact the living, right? It's going to impact the taxes that are paid. It's going to impact the housing market. It's going to impact, our society. I mean, you can't decide that you're just going to throw away all of these lives and it not have profound impacts on the society. When before that virus showed up, you relied upon that individual. You know, you relied upon them to do their job, whatever it was. You relied upon them to pay their taxes, however much that was. You know, they were productive citizens until you totally fucked up the pandemic response, and then they became disabled. That's the bottom line. People have an inability to see past their feet. That's the problem, that we're facing. It's all in the immediate, and there's no long-term thinking, whatsoever, you know. There's no critical thinking. They can't say, like I said, I write software. Well, you know, if this happens, then do this. If that happens, then do this. Else do this. You know, it's like plotting out a program with if then else statements. You know, it's pretty easy to see, you know, what's going to happen. If you do this, then this is going to happen, and then you're going to have to do this. But like I said, we're not there, and I seriously doubt we're ever going to get there, to be honest, because all of our government leaders have been serially infected. The medical community has been serially infected. They've not spoken up and warned people of the dangers so that people won't go out and continue to live as if, you know, it was 2000, you know. I don't know. It's deeply concerning to me.
Thank you so much for sharing with us your wealth of knowledge and being so generous with your knowledge and time.
Yeah, you're more than welcome.
My goodness. Shall we open up the floor, Crystal, and see if anyone has questions for Daniel?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm seeing a lot of familiar people. Thank you so much for joining us. And I know some people couldn't even join in either because we're just having technical issues on our spaces tonight.
Elmo's always fucking with me.
I think so. I think so.
If not, I have thrown a lot of the articles that we've discussed and that Daniel discussed today into the little chat space. If you see at the bottom right, the little chat icon with the six right now, there's a bunch of those articles that we talked about in there as well, if you want to take a peek.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, that's funny that you put Oculus's paper in there, because what happened, I had posted that several times on Twitter, and one of the other authors had been getting a lot of emails saying that article had been accessed, and so he found out who it was, and we talked, I guess it was in December. He's out of Texas, University of Texas at San Francisco. Super nice guy, but that's funny. I guess they'll get a few more dings on their email.
Oh, yeah, I'm all about collecting all of the articles.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, there's a ton in that one document there. There's a section for grading neurocognitive impairment based upon different cerebrospinal fluid markers, and all of those articles are in here as well. I have not gone through and Googled every single one of these as it relates to SARS-CoV-2, but the majority of them I have found. So I know a lot of people have asked, you know, well, how can I, you know, what biomarkers can I use? I decided to throw that in there with the journal article citations.
Well, Mel, do you have any questions?
Oh, I have a question for the both of you and for our forensic psychologist on board. So if you have a generation of kids who have an insulted corpus callosum, and their misinformation factory, as Daniel calls them. And the corpus callosum is responsible for higher cognitive thinking, emotional regulation, impulse control. And the insult to the corpus callosum leads to lack of empathy, lack of perspective taking. I don't know, what kind of people will they turn into eventually? Because, I mean, you have these individuals with persistent brain damage and viral persistence, and they have a lack of impulse control, lack of perspective taking, lack of empathy. It sounds kind of psychopath making.
Well, I'll start with this one. I cannot comment on this as a psychologist. And there is not, I would hesitate to ever comment on that, because it's personality development and the choices we make is not that one-to-one, and it's not that black and white. So, in the same way of saying, like, we have a very individualist culture right now as it is, and are sort of supporting a lot of these characteristics as well. So will greater impulsivity and less emotional regulation cause troubles? Yes, it will. But what the extent is of that and what it's going to look like, I don't think any of us know, but I think we can see where it's headed, and that's not a great place.
Yeah, you know, I don't consider myself to be a psychopath. I don't know. I've not asked anybody else. You know, impulse, you know, is somewhat of an issue for me, but you know, not it, it's more in a self-destructive kind of way. You know, go and buy a bottle of wine and drink it. Not so much, you know, harming others, you know, but going back to what I was talking about earlier, because my corpus callosum was malformed at birth, you know, there were these compensatory mechanisms that took place as opposed to having one that was well-formed in two separate cerebral hemispheres, and then there being an insult that would prevent communication between those two. My cerebral hemispheres are essentially one. They're joined together, basically. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting. More sad, I think, than interesting. You know, we've it was in Chertow's study, and we've already seen other studies coming out, which, you know, we already knew based upon Chertow's study was what was going to happen. But he observed viral persistence in the basal ganglia to which the substantia nigra belongs, which is responsible for dopamine production. And when there is insult or injury, Parkinson's can develop. And we've, you know, seen people with the new onset of Parkinson's disease. And so it's, you know, once it's gone, it's gone. You know, there's no correcting cortical atrophy or gray matter loss, you know, and it's extremely sad that people have tweeted and retweeted these articles and not thought about the actual individuals that were a part of that study. Those are individuals' lives that are being destroyed on a daily basis and will continue to be destroyed because the basics haven't been addressed, and that is stopping viral replication. And we're, you know, not
well, and the ethics of continuing to re-enroll people and do these things when we refuse to address the most obvious solutions and answers is just something we're going to have to behold as we look back on this historically.
Yeah, and it's going to be extremely unkind.
As it should be.
I don't think that anyone will be forgiven. I can't imagine. And, you know, as more and more evidence comes out that's going to allow parallels to be drawn as if they can't already be drawn, it's really going to be a black eye, you know, because the medical community and everyone was in possession of everything that they needed. They had a playbook. They had 40 years of evidence-based medicine upon which to rely to solve this problem and quickly. And, you know, it's, like I said, this is going to be a chronic disease that will not be able to be managed because it has been allowed to spiral out of control. And unlike with HIV/AIDS, the medical community has been serially infected and is dealing with the same thing, the same complications as its patients.
This is the wild thing, is that with none of these things that we like to compare COVID to Have we ever said go out and get infected 3-4 times a year with minimal intervention, minimal sort of anything that you can do for treatment, and that you're going to be fine? We haven't tried this experiment before, despite what everybody seems to be saying, and it doesn't end well.
No, it doesn't. And, you know, I think that represents just the breakdown in our educational system, that we have produced individuals that are that grossly incompetent. I mean, there are so many journal articles, right, that talk about all these pathophysiological processes that are taking place in people. And yet we still have individuals that, like you said, subscribe to the idea that it is okay and should be encouraged to get infected with something that can, you know, result in cortical atrophy, osteoporosis, disseminated intravascular coagulation, depletion of your CD4 cells. I mean, it's really remarkable. You know, we're all it's like we're all dumbasses.
Oh, thank you.